just since the cabinet of Dr. Caligari have critics been so enthusiastic. Never before have audiences been so terrified. Never again will you experience a tale of terror to compare with The Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus. Here is a strange and fascinating motion picture that the London Observer compared with the ghastly elegance that often suggests Tennessee Williams in one of his more abnormal moods. A mature horror film that the Paris critics called worthy of the great horror classics of our time. Starring Pierre Brazeur as the depraved scientist who used beautiful women in the most frightening way imaginable. Alida Valli as the accomplice who procured the young girls he needed so desperately. Juliette Magnel as the innocent victim of a madman's perversity. The Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus. Motion picture as fascinating as it is fantastic, as unusual as it is shocking, as frightening as anything you will ever see on a motion picture screen.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Dan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, the author and musician and co-writer of Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree, our new book, about which more later, and also of Fishhead, which it came out, I think, in 2011, Michael, correct?
I think we got Fishhead off the ground in 2011. It seems very recent because the impression of putting the book together is still very fresh. Ghastly Southern Gothic horror novel.
Yes, with a lot of selected short subjects with it, I'm proud to be.
And, oh yeah, well, you know, a 90-page book doesn't have much of a plop factor, so
that's true.
So you got to build it out. A good anthology covers a lot of sins.
It does, and you do good anthologies. I'm telling you, with Cremo, your Cremo Studios, the Cremo Studios bunch down there. Guillermo del Toro did the. Did the introduction for you.
Yeah, Guillermo's an old pal. He and I go back to the first U.S. showing of Kronos, his breakout film from Guadalajara. Mm-hmm. And I've had the pleasure of being one of the early festival persons to bring Kronos to the United States.
I see.
And okay. What a great cat. We met on... like, what's this guy going to be like? What do I expect? Kronos mm-hmm. is a very forbidding film.
Yes.
And I'm delighted to learn that not only is Guillermo a fellow with a great sense of humor and a very garrulous manner, but he also knew a lot of the stuff. This was in 1993. Knew a lot of the stuff that like you and I had been doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Carnival of Souls, the graphic novel, for example. Mm-hmm.
And, well, he and Stephen King both gave their imprimatur to that one, didn't they?
Yeah. So it helps to make good connections.
It does indeed. Well, let's talk about a movie now that you suggested that we talk about this time around. It introduced to me two words I haven't really had much of an opportunity to use in my 6+ decades of life, and mm-hmm. that's heterograft and exsanguination.
Oh, yeah.
And we deal with both of those very early on, and we're talking about Eyes Without a Face.
Or, as it's known in the original language, Yuck Sam Visage. Yuck Sam Visage. I'm sorry.
Now, tell me why you thought this might be a good Forgotten Horrors podcast film.
This is, technically, it falls outside the boundaries of Forgotten Horrors,
right.
But so what? It is a resolutely French film. which puts it outside the province.
Yes.
It is a considered an art film. I mean, you want to go get the DVD, you're going to spring $50 for the Criterion edition.
Yes, which is the one we saw.
and what a terrific film. But the root of the film, we often hear in the film scholarship racket how, let's say, a lot of the great French filmmakers owe their careers to Monogram Pictures, the old Poverty Row studio in off Hollywood.
Now, you've made that connection, in fact. In
yes,
some,
that has been a common connection. It's like I think the original Breathless bears a dedication to Monogram Pictures.
And how do you see that? How do you see those threads connecting Monogram to the French New Wave?
The raggedy inventiveness of the low budget American studios was very impressive upon the Italian neorealists and the French New Wave in particular. Many other cultures, of course. Mm-hmm. Yes, those American pictures got exported widely. But it took the Italian neorealists and the French New Wave to translate the existential despair mm-hmm. of a lot of the Monogram and PRC pictures into something that felt, well, they sent it back to America, and of course the American audience said, well, what is this, a Oort film?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, how do you spell that Oort, O-R-T? it's very strange. I used to have a booker working for me in the theater business who was responsible for bringing in the foreigns and indies and you know, the import, the off-the-beaten-trail sort of pictures for my theaters. And he didn't like this. He would rather be booking Jackie Chan movies.
Of course, yeah.
And he, let's give me some Sylvester Stallone. That was his mantra. But he'd call up every few weeks and say, well, I got your dang old Oort films ready to go. And I said, well, okay, what are we leading off with? And he said, well, the first one on the list is the X-Men. I said, that's not an art film. He says, well, the guy that directed did some Oort films, didn't he? And so here we go again. The Philistine influence prevails. But pictures like Eyes Without a Face turn your head around.
Well,
like, is this a horror film? Is this a delicate poetic study of the human condition? Basically, it's the same story that one finds in Monogram's Revenge of the Zombies.
Mm-hmm.
Monogram's Corpse Vanishes.
Sure, the ones that Lugosi did, right.
The ones that Lugosi mm-hmm. did. It shows the same story prevails in the brain that wouldn't die.
True. It's all about giving. It's all about giving a new face or bringing
a new consciousness.
A new consciousness, right.
The damaged loved one and the OCD mm-hmm. doctor mm-hmm. who is going to cure that damaged loved one, no matter what it costs.
And this is really the archetype for that, I think. 1959, I guess that's when it made it over here. And
I believe it should. Actually, I first saw it, and I think this was a U.S. premiere year. I think it didn't reach the U.S. until 1962.
Okay, so 59.
By 1962, the film had caused a bona fide stir in the French movie scholarship community.
Because of the graphicness of the face transplant?
Well, no, more because of the delicacy of the narrator. Now, that sounds like a contradiction. You got face transplants and poetic delicacy all in the same picture.
And exsanguination, throw that in.
And exsanguination. It's like, you know, I was like, well, yeah, we had a face off in the corner and the game was called. Sorry. but the director, Georges Franju,
mm-hmm.
Who has of course, a distinguished resume, going back how far? I mean, I think his earliest pictures were in the 30s.
Right, and he's the Judex guy as well, right?
Yes, we're talking mm-hmm. about the Red Knights breakthrough of 1974. We're talking about The Moment of Peace, Judex, of course, a couple or three years after Eyes Without a Face, did a really fine Notre Dame, not the Hunchback of Notre Dame, but a documentary short on the Cathedral of Paris. Oh. That was in many cases booked. This was in to the mid late 1957, I believe. That in many cases in America, this short he did on Notre Dame was booked with the French remake of Hunchback of Notre Dame with Anthony Quinn and Gina Lollobrigida.
Mm-hmm.
An amazing career. Founded the French Cinematheque.
Yes.
In 1937. I mean,
so
this
he was
is like,
a researcher as well.
This is like the template for all film archives.
Mm-hmm.
He was an egghead, you know, mm-hmm. a scholar.
Yeah.
But made films, and this is my test of what makes a good filmmaker. Can you, or makes a good film critic and scholar? Yeah, you know all the nerdly facts. You can put them into order. You can interpret, but can you make a movie?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he determined himself to be able to not only talk about the stuff, but to make it.
Well, I'd like, in case people haven't seen it, Michael, I think we can sum it up pretty quickly. There's a person, a doctor, a brilliant doctor, who has a daughter whose face has been horribly disfigured, and
Edith Scobb.
Uh-huh. And he goes out and finds people with her similar facial features and tries to transfer them. And meanwhile, in scenes that remind me very much, for some reason, of Island of Lost Souls, he's got a bunch of dogs downstairs that he's also doing some operations on. And at the very end, of course, it's the end is you can't call the ending anything but poetic as horrifying as it might be, it's still a very poetic, and you mentioned, a very poetic way of resolving to a certain degree what's gone on before with the, and empowerment's a bad word, but you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
With the girl, his daughter, walking out at the end. Don't want to be a spoiler, and we won't say too much more about that, but it is the template for a lot of those pictures, I think, that followed. And I want to ask you were talking about 62. I know in 1962 it was re-edited and dubbed, and I believe it was the Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus, which, of course, there's no Dr. Faustus.
Wasn't that
in
weird? And it played under that Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus title at the in the drive-ins at
yes,
the same
with the
time.
Manster, yeah,
right, with the Manster,
mm-hmm, which was Japanese horror picture,
which is like one of these Never the Twain Shall Meet U.S. meets
from the exotic geisha houses of Tokyo to the back alleys of the Ginza Strip comes the terrifying news of a fiendish creature that threatens to destroy all who stand in his way. This is the frightening story of an American reporter in Tokyo who unwittingly became the victim of a shocking scientific experiment that turned him into a horrible mutant, half man, half monster, the Manster.
And how did those get together? Well, they really don't belong together, but of course, it was interesting because at the same time, the original Eyes Without a Face was playing the art theaters in America.
That was what I wanted to ask you. So it's an art film when it's dubbed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it's not dubbed, when it's subtitled.
When it's subtitled
in
its genuine
original
language.
Form.
Yeah.
Now, so sure, you're telling me that Eyes Without a Face, probably under its French title, was running in art houses at the same time its bastardized version
mm-hmm.
was running in the drive-ins on a double bill with the Manster. Is that correct?
That is exactly what happened. And I was in a good position at the time growing up in West Texas to observe that thing because we had a college town that had an art film theater.
Right.
We had drive-in theaters that ran the exploitation pictures. And so I could correlate the art film with its bastardized version. This happened many times.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a blow-up.
Yes,
in
Antonioni,
high school.
Yeah.
Antonioni's blow-up in high school at an art theater. A few weeks later, it's the same film shows up, still titled Blow Up, at a drive-in theater, and the ad in the newspaper reads, Girls, Girls, Girls.
And there were, actually, now that I think about it.
Well, yeah, there were, indeed. So it worked both ways. I saw a girl on a motorcycle at the Art Theater,
mm-hmm.
La Motocyclette, with Marianne Faithfull, film
yes.
we covered in the Big Book of Biker Flicks, mm-hmm. and then saw the same darn film not many weeks later at a drive-in with a new title, Naked Under Leather.
Naked Under Leather. That's right. Same film, correct? I mean, not much changed.
Not much change at all, just a change in attitude of distribution.
Now, can you address the changes between, I mean, beyond obviously the dubbing versus the subtitles of Eyes Without a Face versus Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus? Can you go
back to
that?
It's insignificant. It's really insignificant. The cuts were made, or there were no additions of shock value.
Oh, there weren't?
The cuts, oh, no. The removal of the face, not to put too fine a point on it, is quite graphic enough. It doesn't really require, I mean, this is a film that, although the story is familiar to anyone who has seen a number of Mad Doctor pictures,
right,
this is a film that takes that simple, ghastly concept to a next level simply because it is so gloomy and forbidding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's full of terrifying images, not to shock you, but to creep you out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The use of a simple automobile as a stalking creature.
Yes.
The doctor's automobile. It's like, oh boy, it was the automobile is the Citroën DS.
Yes.
Great looking, kind of otherworldly car. And of course, that had a double impact in America because such foreign automobiles were not common.
Right.
The cruising, the slow cruising, the creeping after likely victims. It's Lon Chaney on four wheels. The idea that simple, creepy business can attract a youthful audience, it worked. I mean, this was the sort of thing that really had not been seen as late as 1960.
Right.
Horrors of the Black Museum warmed you up for it. Another American, Allied Artists picture called The Hypnotic Eye warmed you up.
That was Jacques Bergerac, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. warms you up for it.
Mm-hmm.
Except the mutilations are not medical, but rather, it's two kinds of derangement, actually.
It is.
This is one not to gross you out or to send you, covering your eyes. This is the sort of thing that chills the spine.
It's interesting that you mention those two films, because in both of those films there is an extra narrative portion featuring mm-hmm. a hypnotist.
Oh, sure.
And they, in both Hypnotic Eye, they have a little, and in the other picture, Horrors of the Black Museum, they have an actual hypnotist come out and allegedly hypnotize the audience. By the time Eyes Without a Face comes around, it's hypnotic without having to have a hypnotist there. It's very dreamlike and hypnotic.
Very beautifully put together in the sense of patient buildup. Now, the American Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus, what a ghastly title. I haven't seen it under that title in years, but the last time I saw it, it appeared shortened from the French original.
Oh, really? Do you know what they took out?
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
Nothing in particular. Build up.
Right.
Moments that would be considered padding to an impatient American audience.
Did it end the same way?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. In fact, I saw it under that American title on television about 1968, and it had except for the English dubbing, it was virtually the authentic film, and I didn't time it to see what was missing.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know how it played on television, but that whole the whole face transplant thing is still, after all these years, very uncomfortable to watch.
Oh yeah, very, very unnerving. Not the kind of thing that you'd. Well, let's see. I guess the current gold standard is probably television version of The Walking Dead, which deploys its gore effects to good dramatic purpose. But gosh, I think I've seen all that before. Let's get back to something more subtle.
Right, exactly, exactly. Let's get back to Val Lewton, or get back to Eyes Without a Face. And Eyes Without a Face is very subtle in a lot of ways, but it's also, it's got those graphic things, but they seem to arise naturally out of the subtlety of the screenplay of the events.
You get kind of a sense of documentary realism in the surgical setting.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's but. What a splendid cast. Edith Skob does almost a job of Marcel Marceau type acting.
Yes.
You don't really
I never get thought
to,
about that, but you're right, yeah.
It's very much in the realm of mime. Pierre Brasseur's doctor is this guy is really
smug.
Unnerving.
Yeah, he's unnerving and smug and above. And meddling in things man was not meant to know. And doesn't care. I mean, he's really got kind of the Peter Cushing attitude when you get down to it.
Oh, yeah, the ruthlessness. And what, Cushing had invented his version of Dr. Frankenstein only, what, 2 years before?
Only 2 years before that, exactly.
3 years before, 1957.
Yeah.
Right, 1957-58 was the breakthrough for the Hammers.
That's right.
Hammer
that's
films,
right.
And it's like, yeah, that's got to have proved influential in some respect. But it's quite lovely to go back and look at a piece of poetically conceived art cinema like Eyes Without a Face and compare it with its raggedy Poverty Row ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Although I got to tell you, some of that Lugosi stuff, like the one you mentioned, where he's trying to bring, you know, where he went through those things trying to bring his dead wife back to life, is still very unsettling stuff. And you're right, it's you can draw a straight line from that stuff right to Eyes Without a Face.
There's a quality about the monograms, and this shows up even in their comedies and their westerns. Who was the fellow who wrote that very shallow history of PRC? Several years ago.
Uh-huh.
Wheeler Dixon,
right.
Who wrote a very tentative beginning to a study of Producers Releasing Corp as a force in the low-budget filmmaking industry, and he kept sniping at Monogram for being boring.
Hmm.
And I picked up the book again the other night and gave it a browse and said, oh, man, now I remember why I nearly threw this book away.
Well, you call Monogram a lot of things, disjointed, unlikely, some of their, but boring, I don't think ever, no.
I don't think boring, and I think what people accustomed to instant gratification and thrill a minute pacing might not value is that we used the phrase cold gray weirdness in some of our Forgotten Horrors essays.
Right.
And it's like, I don't really think Monogram has a patent on that style, but when they do it better than just about anybody else. And I'm thinking of films like The Corpse Vanishes.
Corpse Vanishes is what I was getting ready to say.
Certainly like Bowery at Midnight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My favorite Lugosi at Monogram film, Invisible Ghost.
Oh, yes.
Which is like cold, 9 below 0 gray weirdness.
Yes. And especially, is that one of the ones that has the oddball family in it with Minerva Urical and is it Angelo Rosito?
Oh, that's the Corpse Vanishes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What a What a tremendously appealing bunch of grotesque figures.
My poor son, I wish he'd never been born. I remember her looking at the camera and saying that, going, my gosh,
we
just entered a different subterranean universe here, you know? now, the Eyes Without a Face is as you say, a Criterion collection. We watched it the other night. They've got a very, very nice print of it. And it's something that I don't know. Even we've talked about it for about half an hour now. I don't know that we can prepare anyone for that hasn't seen it before.
No, I think best to plunge into a picture like this just feet first, no questions asked, lose yourself in the moment. And I think the truly adventurous moviegoer will come out on the other end grateful for the experience.
Well, and you can say that kind of about all the pictures that we've talked about, because we select the ones we want to talk about, you know. And so
yeah.
Joey was showing me that we've got 100 and how many people, Joey? 130, 140, and it's free to join our there is no cost to join. What is it you kids call it?
Our Facebook group.
Thank
Forgotten
you.
Horrors Podcast.
Forgotten Horrors Podcast Facebook group. And we've had some very interesting things going on there, but we want also to encourage people to kind of take a look. Actually, if you go on, it's not Amazon.com, although you can buy it there, but there's another place that you were telling me where you can go and get Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree as well, Michael. Do you have that handy?
Yeah, I need to pop that on. I don't have the URL right in front of me, but I will pop that that special Forgotten Horrors web store onto the on the Facebook page.
Well, I really, you know, we've talked about this Nth Degree, and it really came along a little bit out of sequence, because Forgotten Horror 6 is coming up, and this really covers movies from the beginning of the gore era in 1963-64 to the beginning of the home video era in 1985 with two films, Blood Feast on one end, Blood Cult on the other. And there's some wonderful stuff. I've got to say, and I know it's a mutual admiration society, I don't mean to be blowing any smoke, but that Larry Buchanan piece that you did, retrospective of Larry Buchanan's career, there was a lot of stuff there I did not know, and I was just enthralled by that.
Oh, thank you, John. Larry Buchanan was a fascinating fellow. He made some of the most dream-like pictures you or I have ever seen, and that includes a lot of other people.
Well, I watched High Yellow the other day, and I'm telling you, you're absolutely right.
One of his former associates, even though they were estranged, still called him an American Bergman. And I said, well, okay, how do you apply that observation to Mars Needs Women?
But you can.
Larry was, a lot of people try to liken Larry to Ed Wood. I balk at that comparison.
Well, there's something else going. You and I disagree about Ed Wood a little bit, because I think you essentially believe he doesn't need to be either celebrated or scorned.
I used to be mellower toward Ed Wood.
Yes.
I have altered my opinion to think of him as an exploiter of superior talents.
Bela Lugosi, for
sure. Lugosi in particular.
Well, you want to talk about dreamlike situations. I think, you know, you really are, as someone has written on the, when you get into an Ed Wood movie, you're really on the edge of a subterranean universe there.
Oh, yeah.
Someone has talked about the intriguing glow of decay about Ed Wood films, and I tend to believe that's right.
I think the distinction between Ed Wood and Larry Buchanan, John, is primarily that Wood was not conscious of his amateurism.
Good point. So it was unintentional camp, as Susan
right.
Sontag.
Right. It's like camp is a difficult word to justify using.
Sure.
Its closest meaning would be perhaps over the top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People who try to be campy really have no business doing so.
Right.
Larry Buchanan tried neither camp nor indulgent amateurism. He simply made the best films he knew how, and he didn't have a lot of technical skill. And yet some of his pictures have a great deal of technical skill. So what's going on here? Well, but he was always aware of their limitations.
And you really humanized him in the piece in Nth Degree, I think. And I hope that I did the same sort of thing with Dave Friedman, who's a lot easier
exactly.
to deal
that's
with.
Where they, that's why I wanted to put those two together, because they take figures of in a real sense of great notoriety.
Yes.
And show the depths of their character and personalities.
Well, there are things in both of those pieces, I think, if I can talk about my own piece as well as yours, that I have never been revealed before.
Yes, exactly.
And they're put in some sort of a context that I think, and also I've got to say your Leo Fong piece, you know, that's just wonderful. I know we thought, if I can reveal to the listeners, you thought about whether or not that was appropriate for Nth Degree.
Yeah,
and I think it's very appropriate for him.
Well, a martial arts figure and an exploitation or horror film figure really have a lot in common.
Absolutely.
And of course, one of the things that Leo Fong has in common with the low budget splat film era is that he was closely associated with people like Cameron Mitchell,
right,
and Richard Lynch,
who
walked both sides of the fence.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Figures who walked all sides of the exploitation sector.
Well, the thing is, as a Presbyterian, the thing that I found the most interesting about Leo Fong was his faith.
Oh, yeah.
Deal with in that. And I love the idea, you know, of him making these really incredible, violent, bloody kung fu pictures and being a man of the faith also. I just think
you got a Methodist preacher making extraordinarily violent revenge films.
Well, right. And you also have, of course, a group of Baptist ministers financing Plan 9 from Outer
Plan
Space.
Plan 9 from Outer
famously,
Space.
Even though they were supposed to be, they had the idea that they were going to get Ed Wood to make a Billy Sunday movie, and Ed Wood managed to tell them, as Lynn Lemon told me once, Ed Wood managed to say, well, you know, this film about Billy Sunday, the great baseball player and evangelist, would be great, but let's make a science fiction movie and make some money, and then we can really tell the Billy Sunday story the way it should
naturally
be told.
Yeah.
And of course, Reverend Lynn Lemon was still waiting for his check. But I really am very, very proud of Forgotten Horse to the Nth Degree. And I hope people, you can look at random pages, I know, on the Amazon site, mm-hmm. and take a look at the book. I think it's, even though I'm affiliated with it and all of that, I really think it's something special. And I think you did a great job, as you know, as many of the readers know, and we talk about this, these things came from Fangoria. Of the essays that we did first came from our column in Fangoria, but they've been expanded and amplified, and I'm just really proud of the book, and I thank you for
letting me in. Well, of course we like it. We don't make books that we wouldn't want to read.
You know, that's a very good point. Well, I've got an idea. We'll wrap this up, but I've got an idea for our next time around. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But it's a Boris Karloff film that he made when Universal had him marking time before he could make another horror movie. And I think it might maybe deserve a little bit of our attention.
What a wonderful thought.
Michael, thank you. It's been a pleasure as always. And folks, you can how do people react here, Joey? Joey Hambrick, our producer. Well, if people want to write in, want us to talk about a film, want to make any sort of critical or laudatory remarks, how do they do that?
Yeah, you said it, through Facebook. There are a Facebook group. That's sort of where we centralize all of our comments and conversations.
All right, very good. Yeah, if somebody wants to suggest a movie, we're happy to do that. And Michael, been a pleasure, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Back with you before you know it.
All right.